You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. Each week, I break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news, and I interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter at nonzero.org. Hey, Nason, how you doing?
Hey, how are you? Good to see you.
Very good. Why don't I go ahead and introduce us? So I am Connor Eccles, the managing editor of Non-Zero and the host of this, which is Non-Zero World, the weekend edition of the Non-Zero podcast. And you are Nason Mahbubi, the director of the Penn Project on the Future of U.S.-China Relations and a prominent legal scholar focused in many ways on Chinese, administrative law.
That's right.
And I'm very excited to have you on today because you've been doing this really interesting series of trips this summer that I just want to hear everything about, that I think our audience want to hear, which is that you've been bringing a bunch of students, I gather mostly from the University of Pennsylvania, but perhaps from other places as well, to China for, you know, a couple of weeks at a time in order to give them opportunities for dialogue with Chinese officials and scholars and other people living there. And obviously at a time of intense division between the US and China, it's such an interesting project. And so I guess a place to get started would just be if you could talk about what exactly these trips are, what types of students are going, and just your kind of basic experience.
Sure. No, I'm happy to talk about it. In fact, it's one big trip. I just came back literally 3 days ago from 2 months in China. Uh-huh. And in the course of those 2 months, I had two groups come over. One was a group of students, my students at the University of Pennsylvania, who were enrolled in a course that was designed as a policy task force on U.S.-China relations. And then about 4 or 5 weeks later, then the fellows of the Penn Project on the Future of U.S.-China Relations, which I direct, the fellows, who are all established professionals, many of them professors themselves, then they came to China for a week of dialogues. The class is actually modeled on the project. So, both sets, whether they were the established professionals who came at the end of June or the Penn undergraduates who came in mid-May, are basically doing the same thing. They're all writing policy papers on different aspects of U.S.-China relations. And then in the course of their respective trips were, as you said, having dialogues with a wide range of Chinese interlocutors, including academic interlocutors, but also government interlocutors as well. So that's essentially the two trips that I think you're alluding to that were part of this 2 month experience that just concluded for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And what was that? I mean, at a basic level, you've been going to China for a long time. You obviously understand a lot about it. You are deeply, you know, involved in the study of Chinese law, as we mentioned before. But, you know, how is the texture of these in this period of intense rivalry different from the texture of visits in the past?
Yes, you know, so I think a starting point for discussing this is that a lot of academic dialogue, academic exchange, whether at the level of students or at the level of established scholars like myself, really ground to a halt during the COVID-19 pandemic. And that is for obvious reasons that have to do with the COVID restrictions that, you know, at first we had as well, but then for a longer period of time, the Chinese state did. But that was also happening at the same time as a downturn in U.S.-China relations, which, you know, it's sort of like a chicken and egg, which is the first or which is the second. But in any case, by the time you got to January of 2023, when the COVID controls in China started to come down, you really had come to a point where academic exchange between the two countries had ground to almost a halt. And so, you know, what I've been trying to do both with the fellows and with the students is to make some contribution to getting some of these dynamics of in-person exchange that I've experienced for about 30 years in my own career to try to get them going again. And this is happening in an atmosphere of, you know, ongoing U.S.-China tension, which, you know, has reflected itself in a whole wide range of issues, but has bled into this area of student and scholar exchange. So, you know, I think the contribution, such as it is trying to restart something that existed for a long time before recent years, has been on life support in recent years, and is very vulnerable at the moment precisely because of the wider tensions in the U.S.-China relationship.
Yeah, and how much do those tensions sort of weigh on the interactions that you and the students are having? And I guess it might be useful here to differentiate between Chinese academics and Chinese government officials. I imagine that's a different experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we want to break it down, I think there's two different components. One is the sensitivities that you have to navigate on the Chinese side, and then the second set of sensitivities, frankly, on the U.S. side. So I think it's helpful for me to break down those somewhat separately, because there are dynamics of securitization in both countries that we have to navigate if we're trying to maintain some degree of academic exchange here. On the Chinese side, I think it's a very complicated picture, because you have to factor in, on the one hand, that in tandem with the downturn in U.S.-China relations, there has been a closing of the research environment in China for foreign students and scholars like myself. So the research environment that I experienced personally in the 1990s and the 2000s has significantly shrunk. And that is something that I think scholars generally are experiencing. And it is reflected in things like the anti-espionage law that China passed a few years ago, that they promote from time to time, and especially put posters of the dangers of foreigners and how foreigners should be suspected. But is also
Tell me more about this law. This law is that they're worried about foreign people coming in and trying to spy on behalf of the United States or something, and so they're watching.
That's signs. This is all part of the overall securitization that has occurred in China over the last 10 years, especially. And we've just passed the 5th year anniversary of the national security law that was passed in Hong Kong in connection kind of with the unrest in Hong Kong. And so all of these types of, whether it's the national security law, whether it's the anti-espionage law, there's also, laws that have to do with the protection of data, which, can be read to mean that if you as a foreign entity or scholar are using data that the Chinese state suddenly determines is sensitive, then you could get in trouble or your interlocutors could get in trouble. And so these are like particular points we can note, but the wider atmosphere is the bigger story, which is just in general, it's a more closed research environment. So, and from the Chinese side, we have to start by acknowledging that. It is true that especially after the bringing down of the COVID pandemic controls, the Chinese state did seem to recognize that there were far fewer foreigners in China, and including foreign students and scholars. And so the Chinese state has, and that's reflected in the rhetoric from the very top, has basically indicated that they want foreigners to return and students and scholars. So now you can see that those two points are somewhat in tension, right? A more closed research environment, but then also this, rhetoric about welcoming foreign students and scholars back. And so the end point is that, as I've often, summarized, like the Chinese state wants foreign students and scholars to come back, but doesn't want them to learn anything for real. So that's kind of this, complicated opening for taking, as my case, students and then fellows to China because of the opening. But then, I want to learn things. My students want to learn things. The fellows want to learn things. So then once we're on the ground within the, space that we can, and we have to try to open up some space, trying to actually learn real things beyond sort of the limitations that the Chinese state ideally would like. So that's one set of considerations that all have to do with the Chinese state. On the American side, there has developed in tandem again with the downturn in U.S.-China relations over the last decade, this sense that you see expressed in all sorts of different rhetorical ways in the U.S. that there's something inherently problematic about sending scholars or students into this fraught research environment in China. And some of that can be phrased in terms of concerns about the safety of students and scholars. Some of it can be framed in terms of something more pernicious, as if, you know, you're doing something, you know, vaguely wrong by being on the ground in China and trying to learn things. Especially, I think, if people think that you are being used in the way that the Chinese state wants, as I said earlier, to use students and scholars. So like, come back, show that, you know, China's open, but don't learn too much. So all of that is to say, for someone in my position who both, you know, values academic exchange, values what we can learn, and actually wants to learn things, it's very complicated to navigate the very, very difficult, you know, scenarios that both the US and the Chinese sides are presenting into this landscape.
Right. And to what extent, you know, I want to come back to the US thing, because I'm particularly curious too about, you know, how the students are thinking about this, how, because obviously there's sort of fears of China, but how does that play out sort of in your conversations with Chinese, either academics or officials? Like, how do they, do you sense sensitivities? Do you sense sort of, or do you already know to not address that? You know, I'm kind of curious to get more of that.
Yeah, so I can give you a very, very concrete example, which to me was, you know, one of the most important things that happened throughout both sets of trips. And that was that when I took the students to the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs, in that context, you know, I have a student who is writing about human rights issues in China. And that student, in a very sophisticated but clear and direct way, raised the most sensitive issues around human rights in the meeting. So that ended up becoming a bit of a contentious meeting, because that was a sensitive point that we raised, and our interlocutor pushed back. And then the students, to their credit, pushed back on our interlocutor, who then pushed back on them. I was beyond delighted that all of that happened, because what I want to avoid, obviously, is taking students into a setting and having dialogues with Chinese government interlocutors that don't go to the real issues and that only serve to, you know, afford like a legitimacy that we're bringing as students and scholars from an elite university in the United States. That's what we want to avoid. But if we go in there and we actually speak robustly and directly and even contentiously about the kinds of issues that we have real disagreements with, to me, that's not bad. Like, that is what makes all of this worth it. And, you know, I say that being, I think, appropriately grateful to our interlocutor for taking the students seriously and pushing back in the way that he thought was necessary, but also letting the students come back at him and push their points. That's, to me, the best we can hope for, to take the opening of going back, take the opening of having dialogues, but then pressing where we think there are real differences. I could give you examples of how that also worked out with the fellows, but to me, that was the, you know, that was the moment of the entire 2 months that I felt was, you know, most just important for underscoring for myself what the goal is here of going back and taking students and scholars into that environment.
Yeah. Yeah. And how are the students thinking about this? I had mentioned the idea that this might be sort of like a potential liability, a potential problem for them. Was that a concern that, you know, now that things have gotten so bad, that an American going and spending time perhaps at, you know, a Chinese university or something like that could actually reflect negatively on their future career prospects?
Sure. I mean, the students are all thinking about that. And, you know, I took a group of students who had just taken a 16-week course with me and talked about all of these issues in great depth. So this was not, you know, a group of students who were just showing up and not knowing what was going on. This was as sophisticated a group of not just 20-year-olds, but Americans thinking about China, as I think you could hope for. And so, you know, all of the kinds of things that your question is alluding to, we talked about, and we weighed it. We weighed the pros and the cons. We talked about how to conduct ourselves in China in a way that, you know, took advantage of the opening that we have to go, which I should underscore, I don't think that opening will necessarily be the case forever, right? It could be something that we can expand on, but it could also change. But as long as for this moment there's that opening, then I feel like the students went in there and used it in exactly the way you would want. If that creates problems for them down the road in the US, I think that's unfortunate, because I think that's what we want. We want experts. We want people who have thought about all the issues in the US-China relationship, who then go there and have real dialogues that underscore the differences. If that's something that we don't think is valuable in our context, like, I don't really know. To me, it proves itself. The value of it proves itself.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, you know, part of why I'm so interested in this trip is something we talk a lot about at Non-Zero, is the idea of cognitive empathy, of understanding the perspective of other countries, groups, you know, officials, in order to better craft policy to deal with them. It's not necessarily feeling their pain, but more, you know, going with it, some people call it strategic empathy. How does this help cultivate that sort of reflex among students and scholars?
I am very much supportive of this notion of cognitive empathy. And when we talk about cognitive empathy, I think we really have to underscore that does not mean agreement, right? Cognitive empathy does not mean you agree with the other position. It simply means you have an understanding of where that position is coming from. You can maintain robust disagreement with the position, but those of us who believe that it's helpful to have some degree of understanding of where the positions are coming from, you know, we defend that, not again because we're agreeing with it, but because we think to make good decisions, you at least have to have some understanding of where disagreements are coming from. And, you know, I want to give another example, not just the one from the students, but from the fellows. Through the experience of the fellows in the later trip, the issue of Taiwan came up in every meeting, whether with government interlocutors or academic interlocutors. And our fellow who is writing about Taiwan was extremely clear, extremely direct, extremely systematic in laying out in each of those meetings what the US position is on the Taiwan issue and the ways in which the US is very, very disturbed by increasing aggression of China in the Taiwan Strait and through gray zone tactics. At the same time, we listened to what the Chinese side was saying about that issue. To me, that's on both sides. There's a greater, as you said, cognitive empathy. At the same time, I don't think that, obviously, we reached an agreement, but that's not the point. That's not the point of that discussion, to reach an agreement. For the moment, the point is simply for both sides to be very clear about where they're coming from, and hopefully that clarity can yield some, you know, wiser policy choices in the future. But it's not because there's a agreement on the underlying dispute.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, on the idea of cognitive empathy, are there things that came up on this trip? Or obviously you're very experienced with China, so you're less likely to have had sort of maybe false ideas in your head about the Chinese point of view. But are there things that that might surprise Americans about China's view on the world? Our audience is largely American, so I'm curious if anything like that came up.
I mean, something that could be of interest to your audience is that every Chinese audience we spoke to was obsessed about what's going on in American politics right now, and at a very high degree of sophistication. I think it's probably fair to say that the general sophistication among Chinese audiences about what's going on in American politics is much higher than the general sophistication among American audiences about what's going on in Chinese politics. So that in and of itself is interesting. And you can imagine, you know, in each of these contexts, the Chinese at some point would be like, not even from a standpoint of necessarily thinking of their own strategic interest, but simply just as like interested observers who are, you know, reading the newspapers just like the rest of us are, them asking questions about how to make sense of all the different dynamics in American politics. I think that's interesting. It's interesting. And, you know, of course, that again can contribute to this notion of cognitive empathy for Chinese audiences to sort of understand where the U.S. is right now in this political moment, which is obviously a very dramatic one, and what to make of that. You know, I think, again, you know, for your audience who may not be aware of that, it could be interesting to know that even at the, you know, levels of the Chinese government, there is just genuine interest in understanding what's going on in American politics right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And you were there also during the period in which Trump briefly said that he was going to stop all Chinese students from coming to the U.S. That's been walked back in some ways. It's a little unclear, but of course, it seems to be a broader goal of the GOP and even some people on the Democratic side to simply reduce the number of Chinese students, academics, really citizens in general in the U.S. How do people receive that in China?
So, you know, I think on that particular issue, it's worth noting that it took, I think, less than 48 hours for President Trump himself to walk back that initial language about, quote, aggressively reviewing Chinese student visas. And I think that has been a consistent walk back in that to this day, President Trump has been very clear about the United States welcoming Chinese students to come and study in our universities, which I welcome. And I think I genuinely give him credit for speaking as clearly as is necessary, given the earlier language. You know, that underscores to me as well that President Trump himself seems to have a degree of pragmatism about the U.S.-China relationship at the current moment that is almost unique among American political leaders on both sides. I think on both sides of the aisle, there is a more rigid sense of possibilities with China that has hardened. And it's kind of interesting that President Trump himself seems to have a more pragmatic attitude, which at least in his language about Chinese students encompasses the notion that it is not against our national interest to have Chinese students come to our universities and learn in our context. You know, to me, that is a very obvious point. If you compare the notion of vast numbers of Chinese students studying in our educational system versus the notion of vast numbers of American students studying in Chinese institutions, if you were thinking about this through the lens of soft power competition, it seems obvious that having these vast numbers of Chinese students in American institutions is good for American interests. And I credit President Trump for apparently understanding that in a way that not everyone in Washington or even in his administration has understood.
Yeah. Yeah. And is it your sense that that this pragmatism that you feel in Trump's policy towards China, is it your sense that that is how Chinese officials view it by and large? Or is that something where they sort of don't understand how to deal with him given his sort of erratic approach to politics?
You know, first of all, I do think that there's a lot of consistency in his approach to China. People often forget the period from 2016 to essentially the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. Yes, that was a period in terms of Trump's China policy. Yes, that was a period in which you had the onset of the U.S.-China trade war, but there was also, you know, sort of a resolution of that towards the end of that period. And there was some stabilization already. And now everything kind of went haywire with the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. And so all of that got forgotten. But if you just took that early period and then you compared it to Trump's approach right now, more or less the same, you know, tough rhetoric on trade issues, but then an opening for negotiation. And I think the Chinese side came to understand that both in the first term and kind of understands it now, that unlike many others in the, you know, political environment in the United States, it doesn't seem like President Trump himself views China as an existential threat. He clearly views China as a trade competitor with which he wants to compete vigorously. And that's what you see with the, you know, the discussion about tariffs and export controls and all the rest. But it's something that he's also interested in having pragmatic negotiation over. And so, you know, this could not be the end of the story, but for this particular moment, as we're having this conversation in, what is it, early July of 2025, there seems to be a moment here where both sides are approaching the trade negotiation with some degree of pragmatism, and it could yield a general stabilization of relations. Now, stabilization of relations doesn't mean we go back to U.S.-China relations of 10, 15, 20, 25 years ago. The two countries are just in two different circumstances right now for that to be plausible. But I think it can be a stabilization that at least sets a kind of a new equilibrium that does not spill out into complete chaos.
Right. Well, fingers firmly crossed on that one. I'm curious maybe to come back a little bit because we were talking about the issue of Chinese students in the United States. And this is actually very useful because you are yourself an expert in many areas of Chinese law. And I know that the thing that comes up on the Republican side with this is a view that there's somehow this patchwork of Chinese laws that basically make it so that Chinese students amount to spies in the United States. I tend to think that this is rooted in just a general desire to kick out immigrants from this particular group on the right. But I'm curious if you could speak to some of those laws that they tend to cite and what they do and don't actually mean.
Yeah, you know, it's very unfortunate that this has sort of become sort of this idea that has sort of rigidified in our political discourse, and that, you know, I think is still not the dominant idea, but enough people hold it that you kind of have to take it seriously. And, you know, as we think about that idea, I think we have to disaggregate, you know, Chinese students who are studying in STEM fields versus Chinese students who are studying in other fields. You know, obviously I teach law among other areas, you know, so that they are different types of situations. Mm-hmm. What I think we know from the outside of any kind of, you know, governmental processes that may have more information than we do on the outside is that there are dynamics of intimidation amongst Chinese students studying abroad. We know that. We know that, you know, sometimes that's exhibited through the activities of Chinese students and scholars associations. We know that there are some credible degree of, you know, reporting on Chinese students who say things in class. And those are all very troubling. And I think they are accentuated by the fact that in recent years, the Chinese state has basically made it so that even student groups in the United States should have party committees. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that I think we should genuinely be concerned about. But if we're talking about espionage, if we're talking about, you know, surreptitiously gaining access to, you know, privileged information and then sending it back to, you know, Chinese authorities, I don't think we have a lot of evidence of that. And partly that's because we have an open research environment, right? And so, you know, we're not, our universities are not, you know, what's the word that, you know, they're not skiffs, right? Like, you know, so we have open research environments, and part of the whole dynamic of an open research environment is that you expect the best and the brightest from both our country and from around the world to come into that open research environment and then make their own contributions. If let's say a Chinese student were to come to the US into that open research environment and learn science and then go back to China and then contribute to scientific development in China based on what they learned here, I mean, that is not espionage. Like, we should be absolutely clear about that. The part that is like the surreptitious and, you know, in some kind of, you know, wrongful way, passing on privileged information back, I don't know that we have a lot of examples of that. Right. But the overall dynamics of the, as I said, like the pressures that Chinese students and scholars associations can impose on Chinese students, and some of the monitoring classrooms, it can cause us to have these wider sets of concerns. And so, you know, I tend to think the best way forward here is for us to be more clear-eyed about what the actual dynamics are and what the risks are, but also for the Chinese state to not contribute to the concerns about Chinese students. You know, the Chinese state needs to back off their own students. Right. That should be happening almost at the same time as we are right-sizing our sense of what the actual risk is.
Yeah, I mean, it points to the way in which the broader tensions just create these cycles of escalation in so many little areas, right? Where, you know, if there's a small thing that China is doing here that we're doing in China, it can really set off a bunch of fear and paranoia that just sort of jumps back and forth.
I think that's right. And, you know, what I have hoped for, but I'm not always sure is realistic, is that we can find a way to acknowledge that US-China competition will be real and robust across many different areas, including trade, including technology, including geostrategic influence, including, you know, whatever our militaries are doing in the South China Sea, but that this arena of learning and academic exchange can be cordoned off from all the rest of that. I know that may not be realistic, but it's sort of what I'm trying to do, frankly, and I think has lots of different values, including to contribute to the cognitive empathy that you were referring to earlier, but also at least keeping some dynamic of stability in what could be a more, you know, unstable overall environment.
Yeah, and you've talked in the past about the idea that there's something of an epistemic crisis in China studies, something of a future perhaps on the horizon in which we're going to have, you know, Chinaology or whatever, like Kremlinology once upon a time. Can you talk a little bit about what is lost when scholars are not able to go there and have these conversations, and how that can sort of spin out?
Yeah, and, you know, like I have said in the past, I very much hope we can avoid the, you know, Kremlinology analog in China studies. We have learned a lot in the last 40 years since the normalization of relations, when it became possible for American scholars to go to China and to do, you know, real research. It's almost beyond my comprehension that we could lose that. You know, that's a lot of what drives my own thinking about all these issues, is that it is, no matter how you view China, whether you view it as a systemic competitor, whether you view it as something more than that or something less than that, it seems obvious we should have knowledge about China, and real knowledge. Not the curated knowledge that the Chinese state ideally wants, right? The Chinese state wants, you know, YouTube influencers to come and you know, have very superficial experiences and just kind of like relay them to superficial audiences. But that is not what I think we talk about when we talk about doing actual real research in China. If I put any point out in the public discourse, it's that what we have learned by having all these generations of scholars go to China in the last few decades and do all sorts of intensive on-the-ground fieldwork is incredibly valuable. And it is the kind of thing that we should fight to preserve, even though, as I said, it could be the wider dynamics make it harder and harder to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I guess, one way in which that fight is really challenging is that you're specifically seeing in so many cases, and we've even seen this happen in recent months, where specific universities in the U.S. have, under pressure, decided to withdraw from programs that put them in touch or in continued sort of research capacities with universities inside of China. I mean, how do you navigate that sort of environment of pressure, given that you are actually doing one of these programs?
You have to be extraordinarily careful. I think, you know, for much of my career, I've understood that there were things to be careful about in the Chinese environment. And now I'm just as clear that there are things to be careful about in our environment. And that requires a lot of thoughtfulness. I think there are ways in which one could have the kind of programs that I'm doing in China that are more open to you know, attack for being somehow problematic. And so I'm very aware of that. And that includes being very, very careful about funding. You know, so any programs that I'm doing through the Penn Project on the Future of U.S.-China Relations, we are very explicit about the funding. It's right on our website. It's funded by the premier American foundations who have supported work on China for decades. So, you know, that's one thing to be extremely careful about. It's extremely important to have our own autonomy in choosing the experiences we're having in China. Obviously, we have interlocutors, and that's part of the whole experience, but, you know, being careful about what those dynamics are, using the opportunities to raise the issues that are real and that indicate the disagreements between the U.S. and China, and not simply going and, you know, offering, you know, photo ops to, like, present China in a particular way. And obviously, avoiding connectivity with any kinds of, you know, actors in the Chinese situation that, you know, we would think of in the U.S. context as being, you know, beyond the pale, right? So just to, you know, give a concrete example of that, I have no intention whatsoever of taking a group of students or fellows to the Xinjiang region of China, which has been marked by incredible persecution of the Uyghur population for the last at least 4 or 5 years, if not longer. You know, those are steps one can take to indicate that one understands the red lines in the U.S. context. And I think they're important. I think, you know, if any university program like what I'm running is not mindful of that, it's both, you know, wrong on its own terms, but also incredibly callous in terms of the risks here. To the extent that someone could have a concern with, we don't even want you to go to China to have real discussions and real debates with Chinese interlocutors, I'll defend that position. You know, maybe people will disagree with that, but I feel comfortable defending the position. But that's what I want to defend. I don't want to defend other vulnerabilities that are clearly possible in this area and that I try to be very careful about.
Right. I'm curious. I know that y'all met at at least for this latest group, I believe, with the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador there, David Perdue. I don't know if you can speak specifically to that conversation, but I'm curious to get your sense of sort of how the Trump administration is approaching things and how Perdue is approaching things on the ground. I know he had made some inflammatory comments in the past about the U.S. and China being China waging a certain type of war against the U.S., things like that. I'm wondering if you have any sense of how he's approaching it now that he's there.
So, you know.
This was a free preview of Non-Zero World. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at nonzero.org.